This week on Painting Lines.
If you're going based on this tournament, it seems like it was very important because, I mean, Fields made the final and Mickelson lost every match. I think, honestly, that Shelton and Musetti should have played. When they pull out, it puts Fields in a weird position.
Welcome to the Painting Lines podcast, your one-stop shop for all things tennis. Join Eric and Aiden in their discussion for updates on news and pop culture. And from hot takes to betting, they've got you covered.
Ready?
Welcome back to Painting Lines. Last week, we talked about the Davis Cup, where Italy were crowned world champions and Sinner shone as a true tennis star. And this week, we're going to be discussing the Next Gen Finals. This was the final ATP Tour level event of the year. So just to start us off, I kind of want to give a little bit of a background for each of the eight guys that were playing in this tournament. They were the 5th through 12th best guys under 21, which to me is a little bit weird, but it kind of shows that there are some really elite guys that are already at the top level. Alcaraz and Runa played in the actual ATP finals. And then Shelton, Musetti, who were in like the top 30, didn't even play. So kind of shows that tennis is in a good spot. But yeah, so we were left with Fil, Van Ash, Stricker, Mickelson, Kaboli, Medvedevic, Nardi, and Schelbeich. But yeah, obviously the Next Gen Finals meant to highlight this young talent in the sport and hopefully give some guys that haven't been on the biggest stage a great opportunity. Didn't these guys like stand out to you initially, Eric?
I just want to say this kind of feels like when you said the 5th through 12th best, almost like a JV team, you know, like the top guys who are still that age aren't competing. No one really struck out to me except Stricker, Fields, and Van Ash. Those are like the three main guys that I had heard of, especially coming up and in, you know, previous tournaments. The other guys to me were complete sleepers. Mickelson, you know, him. But other than that, no, I haven't really heard of many of them. What about you?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Those are the guys you mentioned. I mean, obviously they were the top seeds here. And it's like those are the guys that would have been playing in this tournament had all of the top guys been playing. And like if you were going 1 through 8, it would have been Alcaraz, Runa, Shelton, Musetti, Field, Van Ash, Stricker, Mickelson.
Yeah.
So all of those guys would have been like, you would know all of these guys, like Mickelson. Okay, I know him from this. Stricker, I know that he did this, like in the US Open. Van Ash, I've heard the name from a few tournaments. But like when you get to someone like Schelbeich, who makes it in and you're like, I don't really know who this guy is and what he's done. But yeah, so starting off with Arthur Fil, he began 2023 ranked 251 in the world. So pretty big jump up for him. He moved up 215 spots to end the year at number 36. So that's just a massive rise, really impressive. And his season highlights really points-wise were he won in Lyon, and all the guys he beat were in the top 100, beat Nakashima, FAA, made the finals in Antwerp where he beat Tsitsipas. And he also made the semis in Hamburg, which is an ATP 500. The other two were ATP 250s. And there he beat Ruud. So he has some massive wins this year. And it really shows why he's the top ranked guy in this tournament.
Yeah, he had a lot of hype coming in too. Because I remember I've heard, want to say Medvedev said that Fields will be in the top 10 eventually. He will be established as a top player.
Yeah, I think he was talking about like there's younger guys coming up and he mentioned like Shelton and Field that are like almost at that level. And then I just wanted to mention he played 41 tour level matches. And I just wanted to mention this because you're going to see a little bit of a trend in terms of the number of tour level matches the person actually ended up playing and where they ended up being ranked in this. Because just being able to play in those bigger matches really correlates to being higher ranked in general.
Yeah, no, let's see.
So next up was Luca Van Ash, another Frenchman. So that's a good sign for the French, it seems like. He started the year at 139 and moved up 49 spots, ended at 90. His season highlights were he had challenger wins in San Remo and Pau, and he ended up playing 29 tour-level matches. He didn't have that crazy of a year, to be honest, but he did play very solidly, I feel like, throughout the year, and that's why he was able to move up spots to end up in the top 100 this year.
Yeah, Van Ash has been in my radar ever since it must have been a couple months ago on our podcast, maybe even longer. I don't know if you remember, but I'm pretty sure he was your news of the week or what's new, like youngest player to break into the top 100. That's when I first heard of Van Ash, and then I've kind of been following him since.
Yeah, very cool player. Next up was Dominic Stricker. I mean, we've talked about him a few times. I think we've actually talked about him last week, maybe. But started the year at 118, moved up 24 spots, ended at 94. And really, the big season highlight for him was that run he had in the U.S. Open, made the round of 16, beat Tsitsipas in the round of 64. And then even a couple weeks later, he beat Rude in Basel. So some big wins coming near the end of the year, probably a positive trend moving into 2024.
Yeah, no, we did talk about him last week, and I kind of compared him to Wawrinka, like aesthetically, looks-wise. But power-wise, he's Berrettini, man. That guy has a hammer back there, just deep baseline strokes and can rip it.
Yeah, and he played 10 less matches than Van Ash on the tour level, 19 tour level matches, which is crazy to think about considering he made three or four wins in the U.S. Open, and that was like a quarter of his matches.
Yeah.
And then next up, Mickelson, number four. This guy, by far the biggest mover of the year, started the year at number 600. He was playing in futures tournaments, and by the end of the year, he moved up 503 spots to number 97. His season highlights really won Chicago and Knoxville, the challengers there, made the final in Newport, which is, I think, really where he kind of showed himself on the main stage, since that's like a tour level event, not a challenger. Had wins over like Mackenzie McDonald and John Isner, and made the final, lost to Mannarino. But I mean, Mannarino's been playing, or was playing, great this year, so makes sense. And then he ended up turning pro pretty soon after that instead of going to college at Georgia.
Yeah, no, and Newport was one of Isner's last tournaments too, so it's kind of a changing the guard, because a lot of people can kind of compare the two, you know, they're big, heavy serves. So it was just kind of an interesting thing to see that.
Yeah, and I remember Gimelstob talked about how he wasn't afraid to play against Isner, even considering like he was about to go to Georgia, and Isner was like this Georgia legend and this great all-time player, and he just goes in the match with no fear and ends up beating him.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, like I was saying, like Mickelson, 15 tour level matches. So that trend, just a line, just continues down. Less tour level matches, lower ranking. So the number five guy was Flavio Caboli. Started the year ranked 171, moved up 70 spots, ended the year at 101. His season highlights, he made the finals in the Lisbon Challenger and won the Challenger in Olbia. And he beat two top 100 guys in Munich as well when he made the the quarterfinal there. So, I mean, he has some wins. He has a couple runs in Challengers, but nothing crazy. And that's, I think, why you see the drop-off in terms of recognizability from Mickelson to Caboli, because Mickelson has this big run that everyone heard about, oh my gosh, this super young guy making it to the finals in Newport, whereas Caboli didn't really have that trademark event where he showed everybody like what his level is.
Right. Yeah. You know, I hate to say it, but I hadn't heard of him before this.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to get to him in a couple guys, but Luca Nardi, I'd actually heard of. Mm-hmm. And Caboli, yeah, ranked higher than him, I had never heard of before.
Yeah. This guy can play, though.
Yeah. Very good player. Then number six was Hamad Medvedevic. Started the year at 255, moved up 142 spots, ended the year 113. His season highlights, he actually won three challengers and he made the semifinals in Stade. He beat guys like Thiem. He beat twice this year, and he beat top 50 guys like Hoffman, Jarry, and Lehecka. To me, I think I was a little bit surprised when I was looking at their backgrounds that he actually wasn't above Caboli, not in terms of just because he played more matches. He actually played 19 tour level matches, whereas Caboli, like I said, played 12, but he also had bigger wins over like higher ranked guys, and he had more challenger wins. So I was a little bit surprised by that, but I guess Caboli had wins in critical moments that Medvedevic maybe didn't have.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to see, because you know how there's the UTR rankings too?
Yeah.
So they take into account the quality of the matches and like the bigger guys that you beat.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like whether or not Caboli is has a higher or lower UTR than Medvedevic.
Exactly. Yeah. Because, yeah, looking at his resume, those are big wins right there.
Especially after this tournament, Medvedevic probably goes up in terms of his UTR.
Exactly.
That was one actually interesting thing about this tournament, was that obviously these are the rankings from before the tournament started that I'm describing, but the rankings actually weren't affected by the results of this tournament. You got 0 points for it. It wasn't like the ATP finals where you got points just for like playing in one match and winning it.
Right.
But yeah, then up next, Luca Nardi, like I was talking about, he was number seven guy. And I think the reason we probably knew more about Luca Nardi is because he started the year a little bit higher. He started the year at 135. So we probably heard of him in previous years, whereas other guys moved up a little bit more. Nardi actually only moved up 17 spots this year from 135 to 118. I think he was the smallest mover of any guys that made the next gen finals. His season highlights, he won two challengers and he made the round of 32 actually in Monte Carlo, which is obviously a massive tournament. He had two top 100 wins there and in total had five wins over guys in the top 100. So he shows that he can belong and beat these guys that are at that top 100 level, just maybe needs a little bit more time to develop and beat those guys consistently. But Nardi actually goes back onto the trend, playing in only nine tour level matches. And then the last guy who, I mean, I'd really never heard the name before, Abdullah Shelbai, started the year ranked 470, went up 283 spots to 187, snuck in at that 12th spot. And I mean, season highlights, he won one challenger in Charleston, made the final in another. His biggest wins, he beat Gaston in Metz and he beat Kubler in Bahrain. Those are top 100 guys. They're big wins, but this is a guy that I don't think he would have been expected to be in this tournament. But now we kind of have given a little bit of a background under these guys. Eric, is there anything you want to talk about before we jump into the sort of results and how the tournament went?
Yeah. Did you get to catch the base camp?
I did not see the base camp. What was that?
Oh, so that was fun. That was super entertaining. The base camp, they did like a cool little combine where they test all the players' athletic ability, put them through competitive drills. It literally reminded me of an NFL combine. I thought it would have been really interesting if they did that with the real next gen guys, but kind of stupid because they're already established. Like that's who they are. So it's cool that they got to do this with the younger guys. Mm-hmm. So the drills that they put them through, the first one, 10 meter sprint, and Fees won that. Mickelson came in last. The next one was a vertical jump. Guess who came in first? Fees. And Stricker in last place this time. And then the third drill, 505. It's kind of like a football 5-10-5, but instead you're in the middle and you don't know which way you're going. So it's randomized. They have lights that light up. So you can't really be leaning one side or the other. Like, you know how in football, you just need to keep your hand on the line. You can lean as far as you need to on one side. But Fields won that one again. Mickelson came in last. And then the last drill was the star drill. So each player starts on the baseline in the middle, and you have to hit all six corners by coming back to the middle of the court. Fields crushed that one, and then Mickelson came in last. So pretty like Fields dominated the whole competition, and Mickelson and Stricker kind of were like bottom half, mostly in last, just because the body types there are. And I thought it was pretty interesting to see if that correlated with the performance. So obviously Fee's top ranked guy in the tournament and was in the finals, but he didn't win the finals. Medijovic did so, but he did not participate in the base camp. So kind of wanted to see if the two would correlate, but wanted to bring up just like how important you think being a good mover is in today's age, especially, you know, compared to previous years.
Well, I mean, if you're going based on this tournament, it seems like it was very important because, I mean, Fields made the final and Mickelson lost every match. Uh-huh. So that gives one interpretation. But, I mean, if you look at all the top guys, just every guy in the top 10 right now is pretty much a very solid mover. I mean, you look at guys like Medvedev, Alcaraz, Djokovic, Sinner, Rune. They're all great movers on the court. Mm-hmm. I'd say in the current game, it's incredibly important to be a great mover. Just, I think the game is very physical.
I agree. I could not agree more. I think you have to be a good mover to be in that top, even the, I would say top 10. So this kind of, I don't know about Mickelson, his future in like as a top level player just by this base camp.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about it though, is you can probably compensate for it to an extent, mm-hmm. but something like this can only act as motivation for him. Right. Because obviously, guys that are playing sports at this top level, all of them are incredibly competitive. He doesn't want to be in last place. So he's like, I want to improve on that. I got to get better at that. And I'm sure he's going to work on it.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. Good thing he's young. There's plenty of time to work on this. But 100%. What do you think about it overall? The like the fact that they did a combine. It's pretty interesting, huh? You don't really think of tennis as the sport to do that.
Definitely is interesting. And I like that there were a little bit of focus on different things. Like obviously in football, like the combine, obviously they have like the catching drills and the throwing drills and stuff like that. A top serve speed drill, or like a hit towards the cone drill, just like see how accurate the guys are and stuff like that. I think that would have been a cool thing to see as well. But yeah, let's hop into the tournament results now. Not really going to break it down as intensely as we did for something like the ATP finals. But actually, before we do that, I kind of want to talk about how the breakdown in the games of the games and sets worked in this tournament, because it was four game mini sets, best of five, and there was a tiebreak at 3-3 with no ad scoring. So it was very different from the scoring you see in every other tournament of the year. No other tournaments like this. And it was on a singles court. So very different. I feel like it must have felt pretty unique to be playing in these tournaments for these guys. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I'm kind of mixed. I don't know. I mean, right now, I could tell you I like the singles court just watching it because of the angles. They look way better on it. As far as the structure of the match, I don't think you can get an accurate, like, who's going to be better there. Like, I think if they played 10 times, you could go 50-50 either way. It's just hard to judge who's going to win with a four-game set.
If you get one break in a set, you have it pretty much. So I feel like it's very much set up for like, boom, that set's over, and you have to just do a mental reset every single time. And that's maybe why it's best of five, is just working on just getting those mental resets in for these guys.
Yeah, that's another thing. That's why I said I was mixed, because I do like the fact that they are able to play, you know, five sets, but unfortunately it's just four games.
Yeah. Another weird thing about it, they have the tiebreak at 3-3 instead of at 4-4. It just shortened the sets even more if you were going to go to a tiebreak.
Yeah, so they're really trying to emphasize this, like, okay, that's the set, move on.
Yeah, it was a little bit weird of a format to me, but it's just it's how they do it.
I know, and it'd be pretty interesting to see the actual ATP finals played like this too.
Yeah.
Like how different it would be. I mean, I wouldn't like it by any means, but I wonder if there would have been a different result, because you know how Djokovic is a come-from-behind type of player?
Yeah, I mean, maybe he wouldn't settle in. He would just like lose the first two sets out of nowhere. And you're like, oh God, well, wonder what's going to happen here.
I wonder if there are a lot of not mistakes, but people forgetting about the structure. And they're just like, oh, it's
They're like, okay.
Oh wait, that was the set.
4-3, 4-3. Yeah. 4-2. Okay. I just got to break him here. And they're like, no, that's a set. Like, oh, like,
change sides.
Yeah.
Or like you think you're at deuce or.
No ad scoring is always, always a weird one.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever played like that?
Yeah, a lot of tournaments do no ad scoring just because they need to kind of get through matches fast. And if you have regular ad scoring, a match can take way longer. So, a lot of tournaments do that so that the matches keep kind of flowing.
Mm-hmm. I've done it once because I was playing someone before work, so we were kind of on a time crunch and we just played the mini tennis like no.
Well, it puts you really in an intense situation, makes it so there's like, okay, yeah, 1 point, this decides it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I feel like it also sets people up though to be very tight. Like I feel like this tournament was a very big of a mental difference for a lot of these guys, because like you mentioned, they're playing on a singles court. I feel like mentally that makes you feel like there's less court to hit to, but also no ad scoring. If you win the point, you take the game. If you lose the point, you lose the game. That's never really a situation in regular tennis. Either you're playing to save and defend from the game, like defend from losing the game, or to take the game. So that affects how you would play. Now you're trying to play loose enough that you can win the point, but also not play too loose so that you make a bad shot and miss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like not even the same mental preparation, like you were saying. It's kind of not a different game, but it's
a unique moment to be put in.
All right.
Yeah, let's just jump into the group stage. So Fields and Medvedevic just swept the groups. Fields had one match go to five mini sets against Nardi, and Medvedevic had a five-setter versus Mickelson. That match, actually, four of the mini sets went to tiebreak. So really close match, but they both swept their groups, both went 3-0. Stricker ended up beating Nardi in Fields' group and advanced because he had less sets lost. And then Van Ash and the other group just had the two wins. Obviously, he lost to Medvedevic, but beat the other two guys, advanced. And Mickelson ended up being kind of like Rublev, only guy not to win a match. Kind of a bummer for him, but he had two close five setters. So can't hang his head too much because he was like very competitive with these guys, but feels bad not to win a match.
Yeah. Great learning experience too. Like he's only going to get better.
100%. Especially considering his trajectory going into this. So Fields then beat Van Ash. Pretty close semifinal, but it was only four sets. There were two tie breaks in it. And then Medvedevich in the other semifinal ended up getting a walkover over Stricker. He won the first set, and then Stricker withdrew, setting up that final between Medvedevich and Fields. And kind of like we were talking about with Shelton and Musetti pulling out, all the pressure would have been on them to win this match. And I think all the pressure was on Field because he's obviously the higher ranked guy and he's expected to win. Whereas Medvedevich, if he loses, really no one's going to be upset with him. Like he's going to be upset with himself that he made the final and lost, but everybody else is going to be like, oh, we didn't even expect you to make it out of the group stage. Good job.
Yeah, no, I know. And it seems like Fields took it well, like in his second place speech, he was a little giggly, you know, he wasn't like hanging his head. And he even commented that Medvedevich was serving bombs out there. It was so hard to return. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of pressure going in. And if you are going to be the best, you have to be able to handle that.
I think also for Fields, I mean, he knows that this tournament is a little weird. It's not really like four ranking points. So it's not the biggest pressure for him in terms of if he loses, he's going to be done for. Like, it's not like he's losing a Grand Slam final.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think? Do you think he should have stepped out, or do you think he was right to play?
I think honestly that Shelton and Musetti should have played. Mm-hmm. I think that when they pull out, it puts Fields in a weird position because he is so much higher ranked than all these other guys. I mean, he has 54 spots to the next guy, which is Van Ash. So he's so much higher ranked. He has only really prestige to lose, but making the final, I think, showed that he is a step above a lot of these guys. Mm-hmm. And even though he lost this one match, it's like, it's hard to win five matches in a row. Like he was obviously my bet of the week last week. I talked about it and I was like, I think he's the favorite to win it, but it's hard to win five matches in a row.
Yeah. Are you bummed about that bet? It was so
bad. I mean, it was good odds and it was close, but it's how it goes.
Yeah. Sports betting.
And then last thing about this final, I mean, I remember my what's new in tennis a while ago was Medvedevich was getting financial support from Djokovic. Guess he won't need that financial support anymore after winning this tournament, making like $400,000 for the win.
Ooh, nice. Yeah. I wonder if Djokovic is going to take a little piece of that pie.
Like, hey, you remember those flights I paid for? I'll take the money now. No, I don't think Djokovic
with interest.
Yeah. Djokovic doesn't need the money though. So I don't think he's that stressed about it.
I know. It's good to see that. Like you said, I wish there would be more players that would do that. Like take younger ones under their wing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, speaking on that, I think obviously France and Italy each had two guys here. Are they set to become powerhouses over the next 5 to 10? The reason I bring that up is because I feel like there are guys that are higher up from France and Italy that can kind of take these guys under their wing. I mean, think about a guy like Mannarino. Mannarino, I feel like, could teach Fields some things. Obviously, Fields maybe has more talent than Mannarino, but Mannarino's been around for so long, and having that support would be great.
To be honest with you, I don't think France may become a powerhouse. I think a lot of those French players will just be what the French players have been doing, just kind of top players, but not able to break out, like kind of middle of the road, middle of the pack type of players.
So you
like
think
what we're seeing now.
You think Field may end up being...
I think he'll be a top 20 player. I think he'll be like someone like right now, Tsitsipas, Zverev, someone who's...
I mean, those guys are top 10 though. Like, I mean, if he was going to end up like a Tsitsipas or a Zverev, it'd be more like he's following the path of another great French player was Tsonga. He made like top five in the world, but never won a Grand Slam, made one Grand Slam final.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe I could kind of. Yeah, maybe I could. Yeah, maybe a Tsonga then.
Especially because thinking, like, you're looking down the road, right? And you look at the top five guys now, and you imagine like 5 years from now, and you look at the youngest guys now, and they're fully developed, and you go, let's say Alcaraz, Sinner, Runa, Shelton, Musetti, and Field are like the top ranked young guys. So if you were just going based on that, he'd be like number six in the world at that point.
Yeah. I think Fields will be more successful than Van Ash. Mm. I think Van Ash will be a middle of the road type of guy.
Well, I mean, if you just look at the trajectory right now, mm-hmm. you that seems like the path, because Van Ash mm-hmm. has had some good progress and pretty consistent. Like, he moved up this year, but doesn't have that kind of rocket ship that Fields has shown.
Yeah, no, he's no Fields. Wow, that was a good comparison. I kind of forgot about Tsonga, because I was thinking maybe the next French player, Monfils, but Tsonga had a better career than Monfils, or who do you think?
I mean, Fields has been Monfils has been a good guy. He's been had a great career, but I think Tsonga had a higher peak than Monfils had.
Yeah.
I think that's it for the tournament in terms of the recap. You ready to hop into segments?
Yeah, let's do it. What's new in tennis? So I have another kind of just stat news. We have the players that made the biggest surges in rankings this year. And I'll just go from 10 to 1. So at number 10, Alexander Shevchenko. He moved up 107 places. Started at 155. Now he's actually at number 48. Fabian Marozsán. You remember him?
Yeah, the Hungarian headhunter.
Hell yeah. He moved up 108 places, 172 to 64. Dominic Koepper, 124 places. He's number 50 now. And then at number 7, my guy, Jean-Lennard Struff, he moved up 126 places. I was kind of higher up on him earlier in the year, remember? But
are these the biggest movers within the top 100? They made the top 100, I assume.
Yes. Sorry. Yeah.
No, it makes sense. It makes sense because obviously outside the top 100, you have some guy move from like 1,300 to like 600. And it's like, yeah, he moved up 700 spots, but he also only got like 10 more ranking points.
Yeah, exactly. No. All right. So at number 6, my other guy, Nicolas Jarry, he moved up 134 places this year. And at number 5, Sebastian Offner, 152 places. Max Purcell, 178 places. Number 3, Arthur Fils, 213 places. Number 2, Thiago Seibert-Wild, 313 places.
Wow.
The Brazilian. And then at number 1, Alex Mickelson, 504 places, like you mentioned earlier. This is just insane.
Yeah, that's a crazy move to go up that far in 1 year when you weren't even thinking about going pro until like halfway through the year.
Yeah. So who are you? Who stuck out to you here? Because for me, it was Jarry and Struff. Like those guys, man, I remember seeing their breakouts kind of in the summer.
Yeah. I mean, obviously Mickelson, I think, is the craziest one that stands out because you looked at him and you're like, oh, this guy, oh, wait, he won 2 challenges. Oh, wait, he made the final and he just kind of like appeared out of nowhere and was like, yeah, no, I'm actually insane. But yeah, I mean, I think he's cool. I think seeing Seibert-Wild in there is pretty cool because obviously he showed up, what was it, the French and beat Medvedev there. His emergence is beating a guy that's like incredible. Obviously not a clay guy as Medvedev constantly is telling everyone, but still a great win. Yeah, my what's new was Nadal making his official announcement that he's going to be coming back for the Brisbane International in the first week of January. Where will his game be? It's tough to say. We can't really tell. He's pretty old, significant injury, but only he really knows. For me, I think that he probably isn't going to be at the level that he hopes to be, but it's really hard to convince yourself that you don't have it anymore when you've played at the level that he has.
Yeah, I know. This is going to be bittersweet to watch, honestly.
Yeah, because you're going to be happy to see him playing, but unless he somehow he's coming out and just playing incredible, it's going to be tough to see him like losing, like when Federer tried to come back the last couple of times.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Bet of the week.
Yeah. Bet of the week. No matches this week. So don't really
you
know
got
what
anything
to put
fun?
There.
You got any futures or no?
Here's the thing. There were some futures we could have looked at. I feel like I couldn't have made an educated bet on those.
Yeah.
The only one I was considering trying to make a bet on was there was a line for who head to head would be ranked higher between two players at the end of 2024.
Did you look at anyone that you liked or no?
I mean, one that I thought was cool was that Tommy Paul underdog being higher than Taylor Fritz by the end of next year.
Yep. That I actually okay was looking at that same line, plus 225.
I
think that'd be a fun little fun
major. I also saw that Tiafoe underdog to be above Shelton next year. Ooh. So that really shows like Vegas really thinks that Shelton is going to continue his rise up.
Mm-hmm. I would take that.
It's interesting. I mean, Tiafoe's established himself at that top level, whereas Shelton has shown these bursts of being a crazy level of player, but hasn't had a consistent year yet where he has been at that level. So I want to see next year. It's going to be really interesting to watch Shelton in 2024 because we're going to see whether he can become like a mainstay of like round of 16 in tournaments and break into the top 10 and become that next level guy that we're all hoping he becomes, or whether he kind of shifts a little bit back, has that sort of return to the mean. I don't remember what the exact term was, but falls back sort of to that a mid-20s guy or a mid-teens guy and stays consistently there. We'll see what ends up happening.
Yeah, regression to the mean.
Regression to the mean. There we go.
Uh-huh. So I just thought it was funny how they decided who to match who up with, right? Like Djokovic and Alcaraz. I'm looking at the lines right now because I think this is super fascinating. And then Zverev and Runa too, together. But then I thought the Tommy Paul and Fritz and then Tiafoe and Shelton, because they're American, like they are very similar too. If they're just, you know, kind of basing it on like similar skilled players. Well,
yeah, I mean, I saw one that was like Medvedev Sinner. And I think that was obviously three and four. One I think is maybe the most interesting because it's hard not to put Medvedev above him because he's a Grand Slam champion. He's been incredible all year. But Sinner coming on really at the end of that year, and it's hard not to see his trajectory continuing and pushing him up towards that number one spot.
Yeah, I know. So, yeah, I went from no bets of the week to maybe placing a couple here. Yeah,
we'll 25 bets of the week.
Yeah, I know. But then we won't know. We won't know these results for another year.
It's crazy.
Because it's by December 1st of 2024. This is when this ends.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So we'll pretty far out. Yeah, yeah. How about a match of the week?
Yeah, my match of the week was the Medvedevich versus Mickelson on day one when he beat him. The match was an absolute battle. You know, you had the guys showing a lot of fire and passion there, a lot of, you know, intense moments, which is always great to see as a fan. I feel like it keeps the sport entertaining. One of the reasons why it made it is the match of the week for me. And Mickelson, you know, based on his baseline camp results, he kind of surprised me just by watching him move around on the court. He doesn't look like a slow mover, but he had two amazing just backhand passes that were on the run that he had no business even getting to, even putting them like on the line. So those two shots could have been, you know, top seven or eight of the tournament, honestly, and to see him in one match. And then, like you mentioned before, four out of the five sets went to tiebreaker. So it was a very tight match. And it shows how intense this match was, because after the match, Medvedevich like dropped his racket, put his hands on his face and acted like he had just won a Grand Slam. So you could just tell there was like such a sign of relief and like battling in there.
Yeah, really a grind of a match. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something we didn't actually even mention. We were talking about that sort of combine they went through, is that there are other things in tennis where if you can maybe analyze another guy's body language, you can judge where he's going to put the ball. That can help you even more than being a great athlete. I mean, you're 0.2 seconds faster than me over 10 meters is the difference between Fields and Mickelson, is what I believe is what it was. Mm-hmm. And that difference can easily be made up by Mickelson maybe being able to make a decision faster of he's going to put it here, I need to start going. He could even have an advantage if he can make that decision faster, even if he's not quite as quick on his feet.
Yeah, that's the great point. Like how much placement and accuracy matters too, as far as like even think, because anyone can think about it. Anyone can be like, oh, I'm going to do this. This is the plan. I'll make up for it. But then to actually execute too, that's pretty astonishing.
100%. Strategy can make up for maybe not being the greatest athlete.
Yeah, yeah. And then when you're Alcaraz, you just have both.
Exactly, exactly, exactly.
All right, how about your match of the week?
I got to go with the final. I mean, Medvedevich beats Fields 3-4, 4-1, 4-2, 3-4, 4-1. I think that Medvedevich was just able to really deal with those momentum swings. Started out slow, could have easily been like, oh, lose the first one, not be able to mentally reset and just get blown out of the match. Was able to get that mental reset, actually take all the momentum, win the next two sets 4-1, 4-2, loses that fourth set in a really intense tiebreak. I think it went 11-9 for Field. So really close. Medvedev so close to winning it, but doesn't let that affect him. Goes out, takes that last set 4-1. So I think just the ability to do the mental resets was massively important for Medvedev.
Wow. And I know I brought up my theory many times on this podcast, but about whoever wins the like fourth set tiebreaker will go on to win the fifth set, the decider. Especially in a grueling one like that, you would have thought that Fields would have won this match. Come on.
Especially because like if Fields gets one break in that final set, it's pretty much over.
Oh, yeah. And you have all the momentum. You must be juiced.
Yeah. You just have the most intense close match, and then all of a sudden you're just like, Medvedev just, okay, I'm just going to win this next set.
Well, felt different.
Yeah, 100%.
All right, and that's the show. If you're not already subscribed, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. You can find us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube at Painting Lines Podcast. Feel free to shoot us a DM or email us any questions or thoughts at paintinglinespodcast@gmail.com.